I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a guest that I have had requested frequently and who I've been trying to get on the show for a while. Finally, we made it happen. She's a very, very busy content creator, a documentarian, and a tireless journalist. You may know her from Breaking the Set, The Empire Files, and Media Roots Radio, Abby Martin. Hot off her recent appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience, as well as a win in court related to the BDS movement and free speech. If you haven't seen her documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom, it's must-view material. We'll talk about that and much, much more in this wide-ranging conversation that goes into a number of different areas, including Abby's artistic projects, her creative work that she does outside of the Empire Files and her documentaries. So I hope that you enjoy this rather free-form, free-flowing conversation with the one and only Abby Martin. With that being said, let's get right to the conversation. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest I've been wanting to have on for quite some time now. They were on my bucket list along with Noam Chomsky, Colonel Wilkerson, and a ton of other names. The one and only filmmaker and journalist, Abby Martin. How are you doing tonight, Abby?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on, JG. Appreciate the invitation.
So I have to tell you a funny story real quick. Clips from your various TV shows are apparently being shown in university now. I was in a class and we were learning about the ideas of Cornel West, and the teacher decided to show a clip of, I think it was Breaking the Set, where you were interviewing him. And I popped really hard like a fanboy. So I always thought that was an amusing story.
Wait, that's amazing. When was this?
This was actually about 2 years ago. I actually went back to college to finish my degree.
That is incredible. I love to hear stuff like that. It makes me very happy. I'm glad that Breaking the Set has lived on.
I mean, it was kind of weird when it was like, hey, that's Abby Martin. Awesome. And everyone was just like, whoa.
I love it.
So,
love it.
Abby, just for my listeners, how did you get into this issue that we face of the empire? Because, you know, I notice still to this day, whenever I say to people, we're living in an empire, people say, oh no, we're a republic.
Oh God. Yeah. When I talk about the empire to people who aren't really following politics, they actually think I'm like talking about Star Wars or something. It's pretty fascinating the extent of the American public who are not aware of the fact that we are a global hegemon, that we are the largest military empire the world has ever seen, and an earth-destroying, mass-murdering one at that. It's you know, obviously we can blame it on the mass conditioning and brainwashing, but you know, there is some level of like cognitive dissonance that goes along with just the notion that we're born and bred to think that we're the best, that we're exceptional, that everything we do around the world is done with good intentions. And so even though in the periphery, like we know that we are invested and involved in all of these countries, people generally think, oh, it's for the good. I don't think that they know, obviously. I think that if people knew the state of things outside of the U.S., they would have a much different opinion. So yeah, that just speaks to the whole media apparatus in general and what the media does to serve the function of the Pentagon. But how did I get into this? I mean, it really started with my passion for media as a construct. I was a freshman in college. 9/11 had just happened. Like 9/11 happened as I was leaving high school as a senior and entering college as a freshman. And I was just completely blown away. You know, growing up in a small town, relatively sheltered, even though I'd grown up in kind of a dogmatic democratic, you know, traditional democratic family, I was like pretty blown away at like what I thought was like blowback from whatever the fuck our government was doing around the world. But I just pretty much bought into the propaganda that they were selling about Afghanistan and 9/11. And I think that it really, the genesis of my awakening, my radicalization happened with the Iraq War, as so many other millions of people in this country and around the world, because it just did not make sense. I mean, of course, it did not add up. Why the fuck was our government trying to invade and occupy a nation that had nothing to do with 9/11 at all? Of course, Afghanistan didn't either, but it, like, you know, that was easier to buy into, especially in the post 9/11 like mass propaganda that we were all living in, this terror and horrifying nature of like what we were being sold. But yeah, Iraq was just came out of the fucking left field, you know. And I remember the media was just selling it. The media just switched one day and they just started talking about Saddam as if this was a valid thing. And then, of course, Nancy Pelosi saying impeachment was off the table after Dennis Kucinich introduced those articles of impeachment. And so I think it was just all of these things compounding into my passion, driving me to first blaming the Bush administration, then opening my eyes to the fact that the Democrats were complicit and that this was a two-party paradigm that agreed with this uniform idea of empire and foreign policy that was absolutely destructive and did not speak for me. And then moving on to a broader notion of that the media was also a part of this, and that they were using the media to sell anything. And so I realized that even though my main number one issue was anti-war activism, and that's, you know, I was super fervent on trying to end the Iraq War and organizing around the war on terror, I realized that I needed to start my own media organization if I wanted to get the information out about Iraq, about Afghanistan, about 9/11, about the things that I was researching. Because I was like, well, if you don't have a free and open media, it doesn't matter what your issue is. No one will hear it. No one will see it. And so that's what initiated my my media activism and starting Media Roots. And I guess the rest is history.
So I was going to ask, I don't want to out you here, but I was reading that at one point you even canvassed for, did you canvass for John Kerry? And like, what was the radicalization there? How'd you go from John Kerry to the Empire Files?
Yeah, right. Oh man, that's a part of the history that, you know, I like talking about that though, because I was too a shit lib dumbass, you know, and I think that people can be moved. And this is why this kind of hostility to liberals and stuff, I feel like it's not, you know, we can push people left. It's that I didn't know any better, as well as so many other people don't know better, who maybe will care if they understand what we're doing. But yeah, I did a swing state for John Kerry, I think in 2003. It was a pretty humiliating experience. I went to like Yuma, Arizona, and just got a bunch of fucking doors slammed in my face and like people just calling me names. I mean, it was a really horrifying experience as like the first sort of political activism that I was involved in. Just thinking, honestly, just driven by my hatred for the Bush administration, because I was just like, anyone but this fucking monster. How is this guy, you know, God forbid if this guy like stays in power. But yeah, I mean, it made no sense in retrospect that we went to Yuma, which is like, you're never going to flip that shit blue anyway. You know, it was a total waste of an effort in general. So it was quite futile. But I mean, honestly, it was part of like that whole trajectory that I was just explaining. It was like the John Kerry situation, realizing that all of this was just completely futile, and realizing that the Democrats were going to sell the same agenda by and large of our foreign policy. And so it didn't matter if John Kerry was in there or not. I mean, I'm sure Bush, you know, he might have been more neoliberal version that, you know, similarly to Biden. But at the end of the day, I think that we both know that these policies would have continued. So, yeah, it was just part of that whole path.
I think with the Bush years, I was, when 9/11 happened, I was only in, you know, like fourth grade, and then went through middle school, and eventually Obama when I was in high school. But during those Bush years, people forget it was a very scary time. There was a real chilling effect. If you spoke out against the war as an activist or in the media, you know, just look at James Risen, who you just interviewed, you were blacklisted. It was very McCarthyite.
Look, Chris Hedges went through the same thing. Look at Michael Moore. I mean, all these liberals in Hollywood love to pretend like they, you know, they're the antithesis of Trump. And of course, they've rehabilitated Bush. But in the height of the Iraq War, everyone pretended like they were against it. But I'll never forget when Michael Moore was booed off stage when he said that we shouldn't invade Iraq. And that represents, you know, true peak liberalism right there.
I always hated that people would like make fun of Michael Moore for being from the Midwest or how he looked. It's like, well, why don't you address his facts?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, people are. No, it's the same kind of shit that you see today. Making fun of people's appearances, making fun of people's, you know, tone policing. It's like, well, the facts are pretty clearly laid out and they just can't address them.
So you mentioned pushing people to the left. I know you were recently on the Joe Rogan Experience, and I know, you know, there's always internecine warfare within left online circles about Joe Rogan. But it's interesting to me because I feel like you're one of those voices that I suspect has turned a few people that used to be on the right, maybe even the so-called alt-right, onto the left. Maybe you changed a few minds. You ever get that from certain people?
Well, oddly enough, I think Breaking the Set did pick up a lot of, you know, there are a lot of libertarians and conservative minded people who really are passionate about ending the empire as well. You know, they may come from a more nationalistic point of view, but they do care deeply about this issue. And so I think I did generate a lot of support from those minded people during Breaking the Set. And I think, you know, I've been on Joe Rogan's show about 7 times in total. And so over the course of the years, you know, people were drawn to my message. I think with Empire Files, it became more narrowly focused on socialism, you know, on kind of socialist voices, lifting up people like that, sympathizing with countries like Cuba, Venezuela. And that turned off a lot of those minded people. But I think that at the end of the day, yeah, I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of people who have said that they never understood the Palestine-Israel situation, or they are able to see things in a different light, or, hey, maybe they don't agree with me about socialism or capitalism, but they respect where I'm coming from, and they know that I, you know, my heart's in the right place. And, you know, I just speaking from the last time that I was on Joe Rogan a couple of weeks ago, I have gotten at least 25 active duty or veteran, you know, recently had served soldiers or Navy personnel who have inside information to corroborate my new film's thesis, which is that the U.S. military is the world's largest polluting institution. And, you know, a ton of military people who are just like, I totally fucking am on board, and I have evidence to actually back this up. And so I do think that I have helped. And I think that the message focusing on our foreign policy does help bring people into that populist realm that you can push people left. And that's why it's so offensive to see people writing off Joe Rogan. Where else? Tell me, where else would you ever have a platform as large as Joe Rogan's hosting someone like me to talk about Palestine and to talk about the US military? It just simply would not happen ever. But that's why you see my appearances completely ignored from the same people who have hysterical, you know, outrage fucking 24-hour news cycles about Joe Rogan every time he hosts someone unsavory. But like, they will never touch my appearances because they don't want to add legitimacy to someone like him.
I was going to say, too, on the flip side of that, you know, I really appreciated your response video to the whole woke CIA video. Is I saw some people that were saying, oh, anyone who talks about gender or this or that, they must be, you know, woke drones. But you were sort of saying there's a middle ground. Like, yeah, we can support, you know, the causes of marginalized people, but we don't have to believe that the CIA really cares about any of that. Seems really like a reasonable response.
So. I'm really happy you thought so, because I thought the whole CIA ad and the ad campaign that's been going on for quite a while, it was a psyop on the left. Think about the whole origin of the CIA. This is why I'm doing the CIA stories on Empire Files, because the CIA was created essentially as a counter-revolutionary force, again, like very anti-communist at its core. And it was driven by that ideology for the last 70 years. And so what's interesting about the CIA is that people, you know, it's kind of been rehabilitated in a post 9/11 world. Of course, with the Trump era, these CIA officials pretend like they're like woke and liberal and all this shit, and they're paraded around corporate media. But we have to understand that they have not changed who they are. You know, at its core, the CIA is a mass murdering entity that tries to destroy social movements around the world. And they carry out executions and, you know, sponsor death squads. And just like I covered in episode 2, which is in Afghanistan, for the last 20 years, they've been literally running death squads on the ground, even assassinating young school children at madrasas. So this is happening. It's very important to understand this. And I think that that whole recent ad campaign was a psyop on the left, was in part not only a recruitment model to you know, try to invigorate the youth into joining the ranks of the CIA, but I think to a different extent, I think it was actually trying to, like, you know, catapult this anti-wokeness and, like, try to drive a wedge in the left and create more division, because there is this kind of weird division that's cultivated right now for people to be offended by liberals tokenizing woke identity politics and actually writing it off, right? And that's not the way that we should be approaching this, because you can look at something like Stonewall. Trans rights have been a revolutionary force for decades. And so it doesn't, you know, whenever the establishment tries to defang something with revolutionary potential, I think that we should all take a step back and, you know, apply some critical thinking to it.
No, definitely, definitely. And to me, when I saw the video, I was thinking, oh my God, this is, you know, the definition of, you know, woke washing. They're saying, oh, this is the CIA now. Don't look behind the curtain at the 1953 coup in Iran, or, you know, Iran-Contra, or any other number of things.
Exactly. Yeah. Woke washing is the perfect way to put it, actually.
So I wanted to get into Israel and Palestine and Gaza fights for freedom and BDS. But first, you've interviewed so many figures that have really seen the machinery of, you know, the empire, or, you know, I guess some people call it the deep state or the swamp, whatever, the establishment. You've talked to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. You've talked to NSA whistleblowers. What have you sort of learned that you didn't know before you really dug in deep? Because it seems like you've gotten a lot of insights from some people that would really know what they're talking about.
I mean, that's a really great question. You know, I feel like it should have deepened my cynicism, but instead I guess in part it has, in the sense that I feel like the system is unreformable. You know, seeing and exploring so many avenues of corruption, so many avenues of whistleblowers being demonized and marginalized and persecuted, the extent to which corporate power has captured all the political process across the board, from the local level to the top, back down, you know, corporations being allowed to destroy and extract all the resources from all of these countries and dump pollution everywhere. I mean, it's absolutely unbearable, actually, when you take stock of the toll of human suffering that's been caused by the U.S. You know, I guess I would say that's the insight above all, is that I feel like we need a complete upheaval of the entire government process. And that's a really hard pill to swallow. You know, a lot of people don't even know where to start. But I would say, yeah, that's pretty much my main takeaway. But I do have optimism, and I do feel like now more than ever before, maybe because we're coming off the heels of the Bernie movement, and I feel like, you know, tens of millions of people are rejecting the status quo in terms of they're seeing the unsustainable nature of capitalism. They understand largely that U.S. imperialism is linked to this struggle. They're kind of, you know, in terms of the Palestinian plight, which we're going to talk about next. I mean, just the polls showing this rapid shift in consciousness. So there's all of these things happening simultaneously that do give me a lot of hope about where we're going. And I definitely think that the interviews that I've done over the years have shown me that. And just constantly being inspired, because the thing that I do is, you know, interview the people who are ignored and obfuscated by like corporate media narratives. And so that means poor people in different countries, victims of oppressive policies and stuff like that. And these people are always fighting with their whole hearts in the struggle. They understand that these issues are life and death. And I guess their struggle and their fight and their fire just continues to motivate and inspire me. And so it just continues to like consolidate my fire, you know, and my heart. And I know that I'm doing the right thing, and that I'm standing on the right side of history, because I just continue to see these people and know that I have to continue fighting for them.
So speaking of Gaza fights for freedom, I was reminded of a documentary I used to screen at the kids at my college. I think it was an Al Jazeera documentary about Gideon Levy. It was called Against the Grain, and it's a very sad, depressing documentary. And this may sound odd, but in contrast, I think Gaza Fights for Freedom has a sort of uplifting element to it. And you see it in the name, Fights for Freedom. This is not just the story of people being oppressed. It's the story of people who, despite that oppression, live, love, and fight back against the oppressor.
I really appreciate you saying that, JG. This is why we chose to name the movie that. This is why we chose to portray the movie in that way. And this is why we constructed the narrative as such. And this is primarily the Palestinians in Gaza that I collaborated with, and I wasn't allowed to go to direct it myself in person because I am banned for life from the Israeli authorities. So we had to work through the blockade with our colleagues there on the ground, incredibly heroic videographers that captured the most incredible, mind-blowing footage that people should check out if they haven't seen the movie. It's free on YouTube. But that is exactly the point. And when I spoke to my friends there about what, you know, directing these interviews and really the story that we were trying to tell, they told me, we want Americans to know that we want to live. And honestly, just, it's a heartbreaking notion, because they understand how demonized they are, how they are conflated with terrorists, how they're essentially conflated by people like Sam Harris as a death cult who martyr each other and celebrate their martyrdom. I mean, that's how sick the propaganda is and pervasive it is across the media spectrum about what Palestinians do and are and who they are at their core. And so that was the objective of the movie, was to show their own narrative through their own eyes and really tell the story that that Palestinians wanted us to see. And that was, not only do they have incredible courage, you know, but they have their bravery is unmatched pretty much. But beyond that, they wanted us to move beyond just feeling bad for them. They wanted us to be inspired to actually fight for them. Because if we just did a fraction of what Palestinians did to combat their, you know, the barbarism that they face every day, Palestine would be free a long time ago. So I just hope that the movie can be used as a tool for the movement, especially in light of how many numerous war crimes are just incontrovertibly documented there.
So speaking of those war crimes, I know that my, you know, boomer mom will probably listen to this, and she's not as, you know, politically attuned, but she's getting there. If you were to talk to someone like that, who may not know about all the issues when it comes to Israel, Palestine, what would the flashpoints you would give them be? What is the biggest point you would make to them about what is being done to the Palestinian people?
Sure. So the media portrays the issue as two sides that are just constantly warring over religion. This couldn't be further from the truth. Israel was a country created on top of Palestine, and with that creation, it expelled, you know, hundreds of thousands of people at the barrel of a gun. So now, ever since the foundation of Israel, you've had a massive amount of refugees that have lived outside of the perimeter of Israel. So what was supposed to be the second state, that Palestinian state, is now what we call the West Bank, right? And Gaza. So there's two areas. Of course, Jerusalem is another one that's an internationally shared zone that is facing its own oppressive policies and such. But you have these two areas, Gaza and the West Bank, that are supposed to be what we're told by all the politicians, the future Palestinian state, right? They portray Gaza as run by this terrorist organization, Hamas, and that Hamas wants to kill Israel and that therefore Israel needs to defend itself and besiege the Gaza Strip. Now, what they don't tell you is that Hamas was an elected organization to run the Gaza Strip, and there's 2 million people living there, half of which are children. 75% are refugees. Now, Israel punished Gaza for electing Hamas by blockading the entire area. This is a 25-by-5-mile strip of land. So imagine, let's say, and this is, by the way, they punished them from the second that Hamas won this election because Hamas kicked Israel out of what was supposed to be the future Palestinian state. Israel tried to actually take over all of the West Bank and Gaza kicked out Israel. The West Bank is still militarily occupied by Israeli authorities in a very brutal fashion. There's a complete military dictatorship that forbids people from doing anything at all, and we can get into that. But in Gaza, so what they did after Hamas won this election, after they kicked Israel out, they basically blockaded the entire area, prevented clean, potable water from getting in. So the UN said that in 2020, Gaza would be uninhabitable due to lack of clean water alone. But that's not to mention the fact that they don't have electricity for more than 2 hours a day, and they cannot leave. They cannot leave the Gaza Strip. If you leave, you need a permit by Israeli authorities, and they are very punitive. They collectively punish everyone in the entire area, and they barely let people leave, even for life-saving medical treatment. So keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. Every time you hear the fact that Israel's bombing Gaza, that means they're bombing fish in a barrel. People cannot leave, and children inevitably are the mass casualties from whenever there's a brutal onslaught on behalf of Israel into Gaza, because they are sitting ducks. And another thing that's important to remember is that Israel is supplied targeted munitions by the U.S. empire, which means that they actually can target wherever they want to with these high-powered bombs, and they choose to target and level apartment buildings with sleeping families inside, residential towers, farms. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The AP building, as we all know, was leveled. Tons of families were sleeping in their beds and were bombed and killed by Israel. So it was a total massacre, where on the other side of the coin, Hamas doesn't have targeted munitions. They are just refurbishing bombs that Israel has dropped on them. And they have these shoddy rockets that they just fire back. And guess what? Occupied people, under international law, actually have the right to resist their colonial occupiers. And this is exactly what this is. Now, that's just Gaza. Now, I'll just really quickly talk about the West Bank. West Bank has been under a brutal military dictatorship that flies flagrantly in the face of international law. And this is where you hear, when settlements are being constructed all the time that are illegal, this is where they're happening. Settlers are encouraged to come from everywhere around the world, if you are Jewish or if you have Jewish ancestry, and they are encouraged to set up shop and post their flags on top of Arab villages in the West Bank. There's hundreds of miles of empty land, but it's not about coexistence. It's about taking over all of Palestine and pushing everyone out. And so every single day, you see this colonialism in full effect, where people are being ethnically cleansed, their homes are being demolished. Recently, the flashpoint that everyone was talking about, because it was just so horrifying, that the media couldn't ignore it. But this was in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem, actually, but this is happening all the time in the West Bank, that settlers were coming and actually physically taking people's homes, like coming and squatting in your home with high-powered machine guns. So Palestinians in the West Bank and Jerusalem, they can't have guns. They can't resist what's going on. And all the settlers are state-sanctioned. So all the violence perpetrated by settlers is sanctioned by the state of Israel. So I would say that those are the most important things to understand, that even if you do agree with Israel's right to exist, and if you think that it's important for Jews to have a homeland in the Middle East, I think that all of us can agree on the notion of democracy. Everyone deserves human rights, basic human dignity. And that means you have the right to be free. You have the right to be mobile, to be able to go where you want. You have the right to have clean drinking water, and you have the right to have electricity. And those things are deprived to Palestinians. 5 million Palestinians do not have basic human rights, and they are not granted democratic freedoms or equal rights under the Israeli authority that dominates every aspect of their lives. And that needs to end. And once it does, because that's an apartheid system, there's two sets of laws for the Palestinians and the Israelis.
And I was going to add to that. I do think we're seeing a little bit of, you know, maybe a sea change. You know, 10 years ago, you know, I could have never imagined, you know, some of the protests that happened after the incident in Sheikh Jarrah. I couldn't have imagined someone at the New York Times like Peter Beinart saying the political Zionist project has failed. He now says he's a cultural Zionist that believes that Jews and Palestinians, Israelis and Palestinians, should live together on that land with equal rights. Have we made progress?
150%. I think that we are at an extremely optimistic time in terms of the beginning of the end for the apartheid regime. And just really quickly, I mean, not only because we saw these unprecedented strikes and actions across Palestine, and that Palestine is more united than ever, but Israel has lost the PR game. They've lost the moral high ground. Their entire agenda is dictated by this fantasy that they're acting in self-defense. Well, over the last 20 years, whether it's the Flotilla massacre, whether it's killing the Bakr boys on the beach with a missile, these four kids that were just playing soccer intentionally, whether it's just the ongoing massacres in Gaza, where every couple of years they just relentlessly bomb and kill hundreds and hundreds of people, hundreds of children, or it's the Great March of Return, which we document in Gaza Fight for Freedom, where tens of thousands of people marched peacefully to this partition that separates them from their land. And they were shot by Israeli snipers and killed in the hundreds, wounded in the thousands. This is all of this put together has really made people around the world wake up and realize that Israel is not who, you know, it's not basically what they've been told it is. It's an aggressive, occupying, colonizing force that is quite brutal in its nature. And that's precisely what it is. And I think Netanyahu, as we were told ad nauseum by our politicians, especially the liberal ones, including Bernie Sanders, that Netanyahu was an aberration, that now with Naftali Bennett, now we can have a sea change. Now maybe we can see a change in Israeli society. Well, Naftali Bennett, the new prime minister, is an even more outright fascist than Netanyahu was, because that's who Israel is. I mean, at its core, it's a fascist society, you know, that necessitates this kind of colonial project that ethnically cleanses its indigenous population. And so I think that all of these myths are falling apart, and we see that represented in polling. As I mentioned before, the majority of Democratic voters now actually think that Israel needs to be pressured, not Palestine. The historic protests, and I will say the word historic because they were the biggest mass demonstrations that we have ever seen in this country for Palestine in the wake of what just happened a couple months ago. Rashida Tlaib, a sitting congresswoman, confronting Joe Biden on the tarmac. Sitting Congress people on the squad calling Israel an apartheid state. Human Rights Watch, right? I think Amnesty will follow suit.
The Beth Salem report.
Beth Salem report. This is an Israeli human rights organization that has unequivocally said Israel is an apartheid state. So all of these things put together, plus the Zim, these Israeli weapons cargo ships that were blocked and actually prevented from docking all across the United States. I think that this is a huge sea change. It's a shift in consciousness, and the rapid fire nature of this shift is just, I mean, it's just uncalculatable. If that's even a word, I just pulled a Bushism. But I think that it's just incredible, JG. And I am so inspired. The dominoes are going to keep falling from here on out, because they do not have anything to stand on. And the only thing that they have is just this kind of weaponization of anti-Semitism, as they always have relied on. And that is not working anymore.
And now we have, you know, major celebrities. I mean, I think Marc Maron and Seth Rogen are even starting to question the narrative.
And Seth Rogen was paraded out there a couple of years ago, back in 2014. Seth Rogen was out on the front lines. Natalie Portman was out on the front lines saying, how could Hamas do this? Hamas is killing these people. Fast forward to today. And Seth Rogen went on the Marc Maron show and said, Israel is not what we were told. This is I forget exactly his quote, but he said something along the lines of, like, this is a disturbing society. Like, so then you have to ask yourself, why is Quentin Tarantino living in Israel? Like, what the fuck is that about? This guy's creeps me out, dude.
Well, his movies can be pretty violent.
Yeah, maybe he's getting inspiration for his next and final film, as he says he's making one more only. Bizarre.
So, you know, in the news lately, we've been hearing a lot about Ben and Jerry's and BDS, and you had an experience, a victory, if you will, involving BDS. Could you tell my listeners about that?
Yeah, so really quickly, there's 30 states across the U.S. that have anti-BDS laws on the books. BDS is the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement that was facilitated by Palestinians trying to encourage their allies around the world to boycott the state of Israel. And this is exactly the kind of passive political measure that took down Jim Crow apartheid in this country through the Montgomery bus boycotts. It's the exact kind of thing that made apartheid fall in South Africa. It's not just an economic boycott, right? It's not just trying to weaken the Israeli economy. I don't think that that's really feasible. It's about culturally and politically isolating Israel. Right. So they have no choice but to actually adhere to human rights and international law. So these laws have been passed in flagrant violation of our Constitution, the First Amendment.
I was going to say, what about the First Amendment? What about free speech? I thought everyone was into that these days.
Yeah. What about free speech? What about the cancel culture being decried by all these conservatives? For some reason, they don't care about these laws. This is the epitome of cancel culture. This is the epitome of state censorship. And so anyway, I sued the state of Georgia because I was going to give a keynote speech at a university, and I was given a contract that says you cannot boycott the state of Israel if you want to make money at this state institution. And so, of course, I declined to sign it. And then I just felt completely hopeless because the conference fell apart and they all ghosted me. And I was like, well, that fucking sucked. And then I just decided to make the story public, and I was contacted by CARE. Which is an incredible advocacy organization. And
the Council on American Islamic Relations.
Yep. And the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, an incredible team of lawyers that did it pro bono and fought on my behalf. And we actually, what was fascinating, JG, is that I filed the lawsuit in February of 2020. And we just got the verdict. Yeah, COVID slowed it down. But what was really interesting in terms of, you know, coincidental timing was that Mark Steiner, the judge who actually deemed the law unconstitutional and ruled on my behalf, came days after the latest onslaught in Gaza. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it. I don't know if it's kind of this groundswell that we're talking about that ended up pressuring him to do the right thing, but it was incredible. The law is now unenforceable due to my litigation. And this is what we've seen in every state that has challenged these ridiculous anti-democratic laws. And what's funny is, as much as we hear about Russian interference in our democracy, this is like the most direct example of foreign interference, where you have fucking Israeli officials bragging about this shit, you know, and basically all of these officials all over the US saying, we are going to boycott Ben and Jerry's now because they dare to not sell ice cream in occupied. They're not even talking about Israel. They're talking about occupied Palestine. And that's too much for these people. So, yeah, I think they are desperate, man. They are fucking desperate.
It's funny because I'm sure you always get the Russian asset thing. I always get you must be an Iranian asset because I'm very against, you know, a war against Iran. I'm very against the sanctions. I grew up terrified that we were going to get involved in a war with Iran. And now if you speak out against that, oh, you must be working for them, the Iranian asset.
Well, I guess you do look a little like you could be Persian. I could see that. People are like, ooh, like, look a little swarthy. I guess you might, you must be an Iranian state asset, paid agent.
So something I wanted to get into before we start wrapping up, we've talked about Israel, Palestine, the West Bank. You know, I think when we talk about countries, corrupt countries, whether it be, you know, say Turkey or Saudi Arabia or Israel, which incidentally are allied with, you know, the U.S., I think it's very important that we think about it in the broader context of empire and colonialism and the American empire. You know, I'm a big fan of Gore Vidal, and I think some people will look and say, oh, if we could just, like, stop it with the Saudis or stop it with Israel. But really, this is all part of a bigger picture. It is the story of the sort of Western imperialist empire.
As Gore Vidal famously said, we are the United States of amnesia because we're like goldfish swimming around a bowl. We can't remember what happened yesterday, let alone 5, 10, 50 years ago. And you're completely right. The U.S. partnerships and these staunch alliances with actually the two biggest violators of human rights in the world today, let's face it, Israel and Saudi Arabia. They are both military dictatorships, and they are egregiously violating human rights. And so that partnership right there should make people wake up to the absurd myth that the U.S. is somehow acting as an arbiter of morality around the world.
Well, not to interrupt you, but yeah. I think there's always that sort of right-wing idea that, oh, it's the Saudis that control the U.S. or the Israelis that control the U.S. And I think we can talk about things like the Israel lobby and whatnot. But, you know, ultimately, the U.S. is the heart of the empire.
Oh, I mean, after World War II, the U.S., with the dropping of the nuclear bombs, consolidated the power. All of the junior empires got folded under the U.S. belt and have been acting basically in concert with the U.S. agenda.
And you're a reader of William Blum, aren't you?
Yeah, of course. Well, the great late William Blum, man, that guy was a fucking amazing intellectual that I encourage everyone to please read his books, including Killing Hope. But yeah, I mean, Blum documents it very lucidly, which is just the U.S. overthrow. I mean, just in the last 50 years, I mean, the U.S. has overthrown at least 50 countries in Latin America alone. You know, I mean, the U.S. has 800 military bases around the world, not to mention lily pads. And during the Obama administration, we were bombing 7 countries simultaneously. And then you can look at structures like the IMF and World Bank that, you know, basically deploy the economic terrorism on our behalf. And all of this put together shows a complete domination of U.S. power, right, around the entire planet. And there is nothing that compares to that. And if you look at why the U.S. has partnered with Saudi and Israel, it's to the gain of the U.S. The U.S. saw how it could use those countries as launching pads and military garrisons in that region to stave off revolutionary forces that were rising, especially, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. And also just to extract, it's a very resource-rich region. Right. And so those entities being subservient and working with the U.S. is very necessary to maintain the empire in that region, just like Uganda is very essential to U.S. militarism in Africa and Colombia is in Latin America.
Right. They're AFRICOM, right? For Africa. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Uganda serves the same purpose that Israel does in Africa. It's surrounded by countries that the U.S. wants to destabilize and overthrow and control. And so that's exactly why it pours $1 billion a year in the Ugandan dictatorship and continues to subjugate the people in that region. It's the exact same thing with Colombia. And so it is hilarious when people say the tail wags the dog. It couldn't be further from the truth. If the political power was amassed enough, right, if we organized ourselves to the extent where the political establishment actually did feel the force and fear was put in the heart of politicians to not support Israel, it would simply become an untenable situation and they would abandon it because they don't care ultimately if Israel takes all of Palestine. It's not necessary for U.S. global domination. They're just using Israel to their advantage at the moment. But if it becomes unsustainable, then the U.S. will happily abandon the project. And that's why it all starts with this country, because Israel is ultimately completely subsidized by the U.S. military.
Right. Once it's not beneficial to full spectrum dominance, then we let it go. By the way, I wanted to mention, since you mentioned interventions, you know, it's funny. I talked to some people about the issues with the border and Vice President Harris's recent visit to Guatemala. And she was saying, don't come, don't come. And then she was talking about, I want to, you know, find out the root causes of the issues of poverty and violence here. And I'm thinking to myself, well, U.S. policies probably played a big role in that. Maybe you should consider reparations.
What a disaster, dude. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's like, look at NAFTA. Look at the coups. Look at Honduras. Like, if you actually look at who's trying to come, it literally is like Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico that have all been ravaged by U.S. capitalism and imperialism, strategically so, not to mention the Venezuelans, Cubans, and Nicaraguans.
Well, then you look back at the... Go on, I'm sorry.
No, it's just unbelievable.
I was going to say, then you look back at the Cold War. I just read Vincent Bevan's The Jakarta Method, and I was just, oh my God, this is horrifying what happened in Indonesia.
Oh yeah, I have that book ready to read. Yeah, it looks good. Also, it looks very depressing, but...
So, before we close out, another aspect of your work that I find really interesting is, I think you're an artist as well. What role does creativity play in your work and your activism?
Yes, I am an artist. I describe my art as like densely organized chaos. I work with paint pens and collage and acrylics. I'm working on a giant piece right now, which is really cool to get back into actually painting in a big, big scale like that. I have been doing art. My art precipitated my activism and political passion. My family was always very artistic. My brother's an incredibly brilliant artist. My mom was very artistic and kind of cultivated that whole artistic vision for me when I was little. Grew up with a ceramic studio at my grandparents' house. So it was always such a crucial part of my life. And I feel like it always has served above all as my therapeutic outlet. And I try to do it as much as I can. I don't have as much time as I used to because I have a little baby, but it is something that's so crucial for everyone to get involved in. And it's so sad that you see like art and music being cut first from school curriculums, and also people kind of hammered with the notion that, oh, I'm not talented. Oh yeah, I wish I could draw or wish I could do this. It's like, there's so many different mediums to explore. And if you can't just draw off of your imagination, you shouldn't stop yourself from exploring other avenues of art and expression and music, because that is who we are, right? And that's how we can communicate with each other. It's a language that transcends everything. And it's such a powerful emotive thing that you can use to impact people and inspire people. And that's what I try to do. And I just encourage everyone to get involved in it, because it is something that is so crucial, not only as a tool to kind of help guide to get out of your depression, right, and cynicism, But it also is just something that I feel like everyone can really find their niche and be really good at.
And I think there's sort of an intersection between art and activism in a way. I think, you know, a filmmaking project, whether it be the Project Censored movie or Gaza Fights for Freedom, there's a sort of creative expression element to it. So that's really great. I also just wanted to ask you real quick in closing, you know, I wanted to ask you about women in alternative media today. I remember breaking the set. There was sort of the risque high heels smashing the TV set. Do you think we've come a long way since then? Have things changed a lot?
I would say things have not changed that much. I mean, the reason that we wanted to do that intro for breaking the set was to kind of make fun of, I mean, the whole set was that kind of establishment media set, right? The talking heads, the people who put on makeup and call themselves journalists every day on MSNBC and Fox and all that. And so we wanted to mimic that look, but to basically crush it, right? And show people that you can just completely demolish the notion of what these corporate media outlets claim to be, but you can still look the part and you can still, you know, be that professional entity, but just be talking about things that are just totally, you know, things that you would never hear on those outlets. So that was kind of the idea, in a cheeky way. But I mean, misogyny runs deep in the industry, as we all know. I mean, it's something that's very obvious. And I've been collecting for the past 10 years, just comments and emails from men, about my work. And I plan to do like a big art project at some point. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I feel like I'm completely desensitized to it because I've heard it all and I've seen it all. but no, I definitely don't envy women. You know, I know it's hard for women in general. It's been hard for me, you know, but it's a tough industry, but I feel like a lot of industries are tough for women. And so we definitely need more women to get involved, despite the climate, I guess, that I feel like will last a long time. I mean, I think Me Too has helped. But yeah, I mean, it's still hard, you know. It's easy to just be hurled with misogynistic insults when someone doesn't like the politics that you're talking about. And that's a tough thing to, you know, it's a tough hurdle because it's not about the facts, like you said before. It's about, you know, what do you look like? What are you wearing? And just kind of a lot of personal things, because it strikes a nerve, right? When you're talking about something that someone doesn't like to hear, it does strike a nerve. And so they tend to get personal. And being a woman, there's a lot more personal things that could be said, I think, than a man. But
well, all I'll say is I look forward to that art project because I want you to sock it to them. And the next documentary, what's that going to be about? Because I've been covering the have you heard about the toxic firefighting foam thing recently? The military is just burning all this foam, which apparently is flame retardant and polluting marginalized communities. Is it about that or is it even bigger than that?
Dude, totally. I love that you brought that story up because that is insane. This is something that's happening right now. It's hundreds of sites across the country and like most of them like being done in a clandestine fashion. And it just flies in the face of any logic whatsoever. The fact that the military is trying to get rid of a foam by incinerating it. That was supposed to be its main purpose was to stop incineration. So it's like the flame, the chemicals are called permanent chemicals because they stay in the air, they leach into the land. And it's absolutely fucking unbelievable that this is what our government is doing. Our military is doing this around the country. I mean, look, 900 out of the 1300 Superfund sites in the US are either previous military bases or are either active military bases or have previously housed military installations. So this is, you know, this issue is so wide reaching. And I kind of started backwards. Yes, I'm doing another film. It's called Earth's Greatest Enemy. And I was sick of the U.S. military not being the focal point for our environmental struggles right now for the conversation around climate change, because someone who is, you know, has a laser focus on the U.S. empire, I know, as well as a lot of other people who have researched this, that the U.S. military is the largest polluting institution on the planet, and it is a huge contributor to climate change. It is the largest consumer and user of fossil fuel. It has, you know, as I meant, 800 military bases, the war games that are going on. And this is like all aside from just the impacts of war in general. I mean, you can go into that all day. But yeah, I mean, in terms of just the U.S., the Superfund sites, the water contamination, the dumping of toxic chemicals, plutonium, all of these nuclear compounds that have shelf lives of billions of years that have poisoned people in Coldwater Creek, Missouri, you know, Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville, North Carolina, tens of thousands of people with babies with birth defects because of some degreasing chemical that was just callously dumped in the water supply. All of these people are continued to deny benefits. You know, the government has still not owned up for this criminal, these criminal acts. And it just continues on to this day. I mean, the burn pits in Iraq, the DU poisoning in Syria and Iraq too. It's like, there's so much that you can say about this. And really, it needs to be brought into the conversation. And we need to start taking this seriously. And I think a lot of environmental organizations don't want to go there because it's controversial. They don't want to ostracize their donors or support base because they don't want to make enemies with the U.S. military, right? But the thing is, the U.S. military is our enemy. And the empire stands in the face of everything that we want for the future of humanity. And so we really need to get organized and we need to get aware. And that starts with massive political education and grassroots organizing and trying to interweave this idea of imperialism with every group that's fighting for marginalized and oppressed people in this country and around the world. Because until, I mean, these countries will not be free. Palestine will never be free as long as U.S. imperialism stands in the way. And so that is really the crux and the core of so many problems around the world. And that is why it's so important to start the conversation and look at issues through the lens of U.S. empire. Have that be your foundation of knowledge when you look at international issues and also domestic ones of why this, you know, the heart of the empire, this country is just deteriorating and decaying so rapidly. It's just like what Martin Luther King said, as a country, you know, a country that spends every cent on militarism, it's going to face a social disaster. I completely butchered his quote, but you get the point. And so that's why I'm so passionate about this, JG, and I'm hoping that your audience, you know, gets inspired to be passionate about it as well.
Well, I know you have to go because you got the family to take care of. If you have any other positive vibes you want to share, feel free to do so. But first, I just wanted to state, you know, we lost Michael Brooks a while ago. I think it was just a year ago, really. And I know you were friends with Michael. Michael used to appear on my show, and he was even trying to help me grow this show. I worked with him a little bit through Zero Books, and I think it really left a hole in the left. And I'm just happy that we have Abby Martin still. I mean, we may not have Michael, and it's a horrible loss, but I'm so glad we have Abby Martin, because I think you're a sincere, passionate, and very inspirational person that is just straight up honest and is the real deal.
Thank you so much. That is, I'm very humbled by that, and I'm very honored to hear that, JG. And I will just say about Michael Brooks, he was a dear friend of mine. We had big plans to work together, and it is an incredible loss. And you know, especially now where I feel like we're folding in on each other and we're more divided than ever. And he notoriously would always say, we need to win, right? That's what we're in this for, is to win. How do we do that, right? It's not about just endlessly fighting online. It's about getting out in the community, having uncomfortable conversations, figuring out how we can actually build coalitions and actually take power. And that's what Michael wanted. And he also was just such a nice guy who was hilarious in so many ways and so fucking inspiring and also super smart. And so after he passed away, I really made a concerted effort. I took some time and I thought, you know what? What would Michael Brooks do? I replaced the what would Jesus do with what would Michael Brooks do? And so every time I feel like putting myself out there or engaging in something destructive or counterproductive, I kind of just think, what would Michael do? You know, would Michael invest his energy in this way? And so I try to just kind of live by his words. Everyone's coming from a certain place. You know, everyone, I feel like, maybe not on Twitter because we're all siloed off into these echo chambers and we just, you know, you can't really have an honest conversation there, but like everyone can relate to each other on something, you know, and that I think that's what his whole idea of being kind to people, be a kind person and have empathy for what people are going through. Everyone has a different experience. Everyone has an opinion formed on what they've experienced in life. And so if we come at people with an open mind, then maybe we can generate the goodwill to get people over on our side, right? And we have to be vicious with the institutions of power, just like Michael said, because that at the core is the machine, right? That we really need to focus our anger and energy on. Rest in peace, Michael. We miss you, brother. And that's really cool to hear that he was trying to help you out. I'm not surprised. He really took the time, right? And invested in so many people that he felt like really contributed to this whole left project. And so I'm not surprised to hear that. And well, we really miss him.
So Media Roots Radio, Empire Files TV, anything else I'm missing? And any other positive vibes other than keep raging against the machine and keep fighting the empire?
I mean, other than the fact that I feel like we're really at a great time and that, you know, we can really create the future that we want. And I'm really inspired and moved by the tens of millions of people I feel like are, you know, are experiencing this mass awakening, and I'm fucking here for it. And I think it's really great. Other than that, yeah, check out my art, abbymartin.org. Check out Media Roots Radio with my brother, Robbie, who's a frequent guest on your podcast. And also check out earthsgreatestenemy.com. This is the new film project. We're trying to raise money so we can really take on this issue and figure out how broad we can really make this film, because you can go on so many different tangents about it. So we're trying to figure out how much we can fundraise, and with that, what kind of movie we can make. And Empire Files, we're still doing podcasts, video content. We have the CIA project series that we're doing, and everything that we do in Empire Files kind of goes against that algorithmic 24-hour news cycle, what feeds the algorithm and whatnot. So, you know, our stuff just kind
of
lives.
None of that like alt media feuding stuff either.
Yeah, it's just, which is sad, because, you know, when the algorithm doesn't favor you, you barely get your shit seen, and it's really only direct audience pull that you're getting from social media and stuff. So we work so hard on these videos and stuff. We work weeks and weeks and weeks to put up these little mini docs, and barely anyone sees them. But you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way, because this, above all, I'm doing what I really love and want to do, and that work will live on.
Well, I want to thank you again, Abby Martin, for coming on Parallax Views. Hopefully we can do it again sometime. I know you're very busy, but maybe in another year or two.
You're awesome, JG. I really appreciate the really cool conversation, and I'd love to do it again way sooner than that.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Abby Martin. Be sure to check out her documentaries like Gaza Fights for Freedom, all those great episodes of The Empire Files, her show with Robbie Martin, Media Roots Radio, and much, much more. She is a tireless content creator and is doing incredible work, has been for some time, and I really enjoyed speaking with her, and especially getting to talk a little bit about Michael Brooks, the late, great Michael Brooks, at the end there. It was really, really special to have known Michael, and it was awesome that Abby and I got to talk about that. As always, if you enjoyed this conversation or any of the previous conversations you've heard on Parallax Views over the course of the past 3 years, I need your help keep this going. This is my full-time job. And it is you, the listener, that can help me sustain not only this project, but my life, which has taken some interesting turns in the past few months as I attempt to take care of another family member. Won't get into the whole story there, but your support financially on either Patreon or through PayPal. Side note, you want to donate through PayPal, DM me on Twitter or shoot me an email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. It's what keeps food on my table and this show alive. So patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers available. That $5 tier will get you some bonus content, such as video versions of Parallax Views interviews and archived editions of past Parallax Views programs that are now only available on Patreon. And of course, at the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout out, which leads us to the shout outs for this episode. Shout outs to Ed, James, Jamie, Ork, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Gratz, Martin, The War Nerd, Emilia, Brian, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views like those supporters, well, then the $10 or $15 tier at my Patreon is the thing for you, and it really helps me out. Also, at that $15 tier, if you join at the $15 tier, you will be able to have access to, my time permitting, a monthly chat on Zoom or Skype. So if you're interested in that and you're at the $15 tier, just shoot me a message on Patreon or by email and we can arrange to have a little chat. You know, I try to make myself accessible to my paying listeners especially. So all that and more on patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.